Welcome. This is Julie Motz. The program is Force and Feeling, a program where we look at emotions, the power of emotions, how they affect our lives, and how they affect the world. My guest today is David Matheson, author of a great community organizer and activist, and author of the soon-to-be-published book, Be the Medium. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Julie.
David has written or put together with a number of other very wonderful writers a very brilliant book called Be the Media. And it's really about empowering individuals and empowering communities. And since empowering is a kind of state of very active emotionality, you have to be really in touch with your desire to move forward in order to empower. I consider this falls in the province of our show. Of emotions as they apply to, you know, individual and communal life. So, David, first of all, I'd like to find out how you got involved in this work. What drew you to it?
Well, I've always been involved in media. I was a vice president with Reuters, the international news agency, from 1994 till 1999. And they were in a unique state in that 85% of their revenues came from investment bankers and traders in real-time situations for their news and stock quotes and indices. But every time a bank merged, they lost the trading floor. So they were looking for new opportunities to get their news and photos and graphics from all over the world to the new online outlets. So I basically built a product that delivered their news to Yahoo and InfoSeek and, you know, to all the big portals like MSN and AOL for them on an automated basis. And it was like being a kid in a candy store. If you like, you know, if you like news and you like photos and you like things happening around the world, it was really kind of the central place to be for me, and I really enjoyed those days and also enjoyed the fact that we were able to get news out to viewers without the viewers having to pay for it. You know, our goal was to get as much content into as many different places as possible so that you didn't have to be a trader on $1 million a day desk in order to see the news, and that to me was a real empowering goal as well. Give people access to as much information as possible. I believe you can all make better decisions when you've got more information, the right information at the right time.
And how did you go from that for your concern with empowering individuals and empowering communities, you know, beyond that? You know?
Sure. You know, I basically had built a product that we needed to, at Reuters, put about 7 different satellite dishes on the roof of a building and brought in all their wires in from 140 countries in 16 different languages. And I would see on a daily basis all this news coming in. And then, of course, I'd go home and turn on the television and watch, you know, CNN International, and the news was exactly like 30 seconds to, you know, 2 minutes long. And I just realized how much was slipping through the cracks, especially in the United States, just how much important information there is out there to help people, and yet how little of it actually gets to the to people in their neighborhoods and in their communities. So a real goal of mine was to put what I... basically what I gave to a large corporation like Reuters, my goal was to basically give those same tools to people. And this book was an attempt of mine to move down a level and really get it into to people's hands and into the hands of the community, that same power that only companies with very deep pockets were able to afford. And that was really the goal, one of the goals of the book.
Well, before we go into actually discussing the book, I want to read a quote, a description of David's book. David Matheson's Be the Media is a text and Bible on how modern methods permit every citizen and citizen organization to reach an audience that only a few years ago was reserved for the multi-billion dollar media conglomerates. It is a reference for uninhibited and unlimited methods that use print, computers, and the whole spectrum of devices right at hand in almost every community and household. It shows how to spread ideas without the traditional massive presses, major networks, and commercial studios, which sounds, you know, very exciting, you know, indeed. And it's occurred to me, you know, as I was reading this and reading parts of your book and looking over the very enticing table of contents, that it kind of speaks to two different movements historically. One is one is sort of a political movement, and the other is a technological movement. That the history of the United States is a history not so much of rights expanded, but articulated rights being given to more and more people, rather than new rights being written. And the history of technology seems to me to be always to be enfranchising, always to make, you know, more available more quickly and more cheaply to more people. So it seems to that in this media revolution, or actually you characterize it as a renaissance, both of these are coming together.
Yeah, and I see, just to go back on that quote, that I'm actually honored to have that quote come from Ben Bagdikian, who was author of The Media Monopoly and now the new Media Monopoly, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, you know, the Dean Emeritus of the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley. It's honored to have a quote like that from him because I was inspired by his Media Monopoly book, where he basically said, you know, 50 years ago, the United States had 50 to 100 dominant media corporations, and then at his second edition of the book, there were only 25, and currently, when he wrote his new Media Monopoly, there are only 6 companies that really dominate the majority of American media. And just like you said, at the same time that there seems to be this sort of heading towards a political constriction of distribution, at the same time there's this technological grassroots flowering where, you know, any kid can create a podcast or anyone can put their video up on YouTube and attract an audience of millions of people. So I got to thinking, you know, how is that possible that at the same time we're seeing this revolution in the way people access and distribute content, we're also seeing this tremendous constriction? And it reminded me of the Renaissance, and it really does seem to be a Renaissance period that we are in. And from that, what I would say is there were way too many revolutions for this to be a coincidence. Every contributor to the book, for example, the film chapter, it was called, the person who contributed that chapter called it the revolution in digital movie production and distribution. In radio, they said the same thing. You know, podcasts are revolutionizing radio, and peer-to-peer, and MP3 files were revolutionizing music. And when you look at all the, you know, you map one revolution on top of the other, there's way too much going on there for that all to be just an anomaly. It seems it's more of a renaissance, and by that, I mean a rebirth of old ideas in a new context. And I think when you look at media in particular in every one of these fields, it does seem to point towards renaissance, whereas in music, the renaissance, the rebirth is peer-to-peer and MP3 files, iTunes and iPods. In TV, the renaissance could be considered YouTube and Google Video. In film, the renaissance is this rebirth of digital cameras and projectors, and again, YouTube for distribution. And just as in the last renaissance that we faced in Western society, there were groups that were trying to constrict that distribution and that widespread flowering because they had the most to lose, right? So I think we're now, though, in a unique renaissance in that in the previous renaissance, you really needed to be literate in order to participate. But as I mentioned before, now any child with a cell phone can actually take a picture and upload it to a website where millions of people can view it. So in some ways, you don't even need to be literate in order to participate. So it seems to me we're in a very fascinating time, but also that is why the book has two parts. I see it as kind of a cautionary tale as well, because there are efforts to constrict this renaissance so that certain corporations can benefit from it. And, you know, sort of, I would hope that just by putting this book out there, it makes people aware of a frame or a phase that this country especially, but all the world, is going through, so that you can at least actively engage in the renaissance instead of passively having it happen to you.
Well, you know, I wanted to go back to a couple of more parallels to the original renaissance and just take issue with a couple of things. First of all, you didn't have to be literate if you were a great painter or a great sculptor. You know, if you were a great craftsperson, even if you couldn't read, you actually could participate on that level, although, you know, not many people could have had the luxury of being trained to that degree.
That, and you really did need a patron.
Yes,
and
you
that's
need, you
another
need, yes.
point in this book is moving people from consumers of products to patrons of artists.
Yes, you
and
need
I think Robert Greenwald does a very good job at that. But it's a great point. You're absolutely right. You could be a sculptor or an artist as well.
But the other thing that I think is so interesting is, I mean, when I think of the constricting power of the Renaissance, I think of the church, you know, which had this kind of certainly had the stranglehold on books. And then, of course, you've had the invention of the printing press. And the use of vernacular languages, because I consider vernacular languages also a technology, and that at least made levels of communication and self-expression, you know, available to a much wider range of people, because so many more people could speak the vernacular tongues than could
Absolutely.
Speak Latin.
And the Reformation, that all came out of that.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that, the printing press, too, is if you go back and look, those who had the money to afford the printing press were the ones who could dominate society by whatever they deemed that they wanted to print. goes back again to the patrons. There were patrons who decided that certain artists would get widespread distribution or widespread mm-hmm. visibility because they were the ones that, you know, the patrons were empowering. Today, again, it's a little bit different, where anyone has access, everyone has access to a printing press. So it's like gone completely beyond that. It's taken that model and just really exploded it towards a participatory model and not just a lecture where one person dominates. Yeah. Now it's real participation.
Yeah, it's a huge expansion. But I was wondering in terms of if perhaps there isn't an energetic phenomenon that always happens, that just when you think all the power is going to be concentrated and concentrated and concentrated more and more, it's at that very moment that this kind of, you know, populist expansion occurs. It's almost as if the, you know, it's almost as if we can't, as a species or as stand that kind of contraction, and there has to be a countervailing force.
It's fascinating that the pendulum has certainly swung as far to one extreme as possible.
I was just thinking of that.
And then what happened when it went over that far? Look at, you know, when I first started writing this book, you know, 2002, 2003, there was no such thing as a podcast. There was no such thing as a video blog until 2004. There was nothing called the Creative Commons, which is an alternative to copyright, until, I think, 2000, 2001. And it's amazing that as far as corporations have swung the pendulum towards constriction and control over distribution, you see these technological leaps coming through the cracks to enable people to do more, right? Enable people to create a podcast or create a video blog or have an iPod or have peer-to-peer technology. All of that stuff is a reaction to an extreme.
I was just thinking about that. And it's, you know, one of the things that I kind of love to see over and over again, that you can only pull so far in one direction.
Right.
And there is a kind of, well, it's not self-correcting. It's because they're made of millions and millions of selves who are, you know, collectively performing the correction. But that does seem to happen.
On an individual level as well. I mean, creativity, you know, it always seems that some are inspired to create because of constriction. Some are inspired to create because of, you know, there are all types of inspiration, but certainly that constriction in a global sense has created all kinds of new opportunities for people. But that doesn't mean that those are in danger as well. And mm-hmm. that's one of the big points I bring up in the final chapter. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but it is an important point. I do include a chapter on policy, on media policy in the book for this exact reason, is that, you know, there's net neutrality. Up until 2005, the internet was considered a common carrier, just like a telephone, just like a roadway. You know, anyone who has a valid license can get on any road and go to any point that they want. And when you and I pick up the phone and I want to call Julie Moss, I know that when I pick up that phone, it won't be interrupted or constricted because of origin or source or destination. Now, the powers that be are trying to eliminate net neutrality, phone companies and the cable companies, which will mean that, you know, they will have control over which websites get priority, what podcasts, what video blogs get kicked to the virtual curb, and it may push us back to a cable TV model where, you know, Comcast decides what kind of content gets priority service and high quality and to who and from whom. So we have to be very careful that in the past, if there was control over distribution in the physical world by music labels and physical book publishers, we have to be very careful that those same powers that be don't take the internet and privatize it for their own interests, because then this renaissance will certainly, at least the digital version of it, will certainly be stillborn, and that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah, that is very scary, and we're going to be discussing that in just a minute. We'll be right back. David Matheson, a wonderful community activist, in the cause of media, and author of the book Be the Media. And we were just discussing the elation of the idea that there's this wonderful technological solution to what seemed an impossible political and social problem, the consolidation of the media, and that new technologies are allowing that to be broken through, but also the fear that there's now going to be an attempt to control the use of those new technologies. So, David, I wanted you to talk about the very last chapter in your book, about media policy and what's happening to it and how we can interact with it.
Sure. You know, as I mentioned, Ben Bagdikian was kind of the forerunner of this awareness that there is a problem, that a handful of corporations now dominates American media in production and distribution. And, you know, it's just six. I mean, General Electric, Time Warner, Walt Disney, Viacom, CBS, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp really dominate print, video, billboards, music, film studios, theaters, theatrical distribution. So what we just talked about was this sort of constriction on the one hand, and yet this grassroots flowering on the other. You know, a lot of people tend to assume that our media system is built because of these entrepreneurs fighting out in the free market, and it's completely absurd. It's totally wrong. These corporations get massive corporate welfare. They get they lease the rights to our license to our public airwaves for radio and television, franchises to dig up our streets for cable. We also have built publicly financed technologies like the internet, and that's what we touched on at the very end of the last conversation, which is net neutrality and how cable and telephone companies are trying really to privatize that, and yet it was publicly financed technology.
How are they trying to do that, and what can we do to stop that?
Right. In 2005, part of the SBC AT&T deal, they put a two-year moratorium on changing the internet from this, as I mentioned before, common carrier and towards this privatization. And the phone companies and cable companies spent an unbelievable amount, almost $175 million, lobbying Congress to destroy this net neutrality. And what we see happening is there's a great nonprofit organization called Free Press, freepress.net. And they've been, if you go to their website at freepress.net, they've basically been helping create a coalition called SaveTheInternet.com, where hundreds of organizations and millions of petitions have been from everyone from citizens and librarians to journalists and bloggers who basically have been coordinating meetings with Congress people to get Congress and the FCC to support net neutrality. So that's one way that people can help.
And where does the legislation stand now?
There was a two-year moratorium on as a part of the SBC AT&T merger, and they basically tried to push this in a couple of different federal acts and also on the local level when the federal legislation when the Democrats came in 2006. I think they realized that they wouldn't be able to push this through at the federal level. So right now, fortunately, it is in a flux. So we do need people to at least be aware of it, that this is probably going to be coming in the fall or probably later in 2008.
So would people target their emails and phone calls and letters to the various subcommittees on communications appropriations? If somebody were really concerned about this issue and wanted to make sure that net neutrality was maintained, how would they go about doing that as an individual citizen?
The best place to go is SaveTheInternet.com, mm-hmm. and they have ways to get in touch with your legislators, and also they'll alert you to issues the right time to get involved. So SaveTheInternet.com is a good place to start.
And what other threats are there to media expression for individuals and communities?
Well, that's, the three main points that I make in that chapter is, one is we really need to expand the independent media sector, which is a real big part of this book, which, you know, almost every chapter in the book is a how-to. And so it teaches you how to create a blog and how to self-publish a book and how to create an independent film and distribute it through Google and Yahoo and YouTube and things like that, how to podcast. But then the second half of the book, again, focused on that expansion of community media. The whole second half of the book is all about community media, you know, mm-hmm. how to create a community radio station, how to create a community newspaper and community TV show, and how to use public access TV. And my point in creating two halves of the book was, you know, one half is really more about personal media, where the second half is really about the community. And it's so important to start local and to work together and to get news and information about your local community out there, as, you know, KWMR does on a daily basis. So that's a big part of the book. Then the second of the three legs would be media literacy. I think it's really important to understand how messages are created and the motivations behind those messages. You know, 99.9% of the media we see and hear is corporate media, so it's important for people to have some level of media literacy. And third and lastly is making media policy public. You know, these, as I mentioned, these corporations that have come to dominate the American media system, have done so kind of in the dark, you know, behind closed doors, inside the Beltway. And what I love about what Free Press is doing and local groups like Media Action Marin and Media Alliance is that they're breaking the, they're shining a light on the media policy process. And as soon as we get people involved, it's really amazing how people power and organized people can beat organized money. Because mm-hmm. we've seen over the last few years a couple of really big wins on media ownership rules and now net neutrality. These are usually wonkish type of policy issues that are hidden behind closed doors. But when people come in and see what's actually going on and being done in their name and realize that they can have an impact and change things, we really have gotten a lot done.
I love that phrase, that organized people can beat organized money. It's so extraordinarily hopeful, and it speaks to, you know, the core of people's despair that they can't beat organized money, that it's just not possible, and it's that attitude that allows people to slip back into lethargy. But I think your assertion and reassertion of exactly the opposite, that people organized are more powerful than money organized, is really wonderful and can't be said often enough.
And shining a light. You know, let's take it right to the local level, if we have a minute.
Sure, we have lots of time.
The Community Media Center in Marin is just a perfect example of that, of really getting people involved and shining a light on what normally happened behind closed doors. The Marin Telecommunications Agency is their brief. They're a joint powers authority, and they are tasked to negotiate our cable franchise agreement with Comcast in Marin. Novato and West Marin are separate. You have a different cable agreement with, I believe, Horizon Cable, but Marin has Comcast. And, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when we started this, Comcast had Channel 26, their public access channel, really kind of buried at the industrial center in on Anderson Drive in the Comcast facility, you know, across from a lumberyard. It wasn't a very accessible facility. Kids couldn't get to it. The elderly had a hard time getting to it. All those underserved voices that you don't hear in corporate media. And so what we tried to do at Media Action Marin was we tried to get that facility out of Comcast's hands and into the hands of the community, which is where it belongs in the first place. And we fought for 4 or 5 years during this long negotiation with Comcast. And eventually, last year, we won $3 million. And that community channel is now going to be taken out of Comcast and hopefully put at the College of Marin, which is where it's being discussed now, mm-hmm. for a brand new community media center. Mm-hmm. Those are exactly the types of things where people can make a difference if they do get involved and take a chance on understanding these somewhat complex issues. But look what happened right here in our own backyard. Now we have our own community media center where we can broadcast public education and government issues of importance to the local community.
But this actually raises an interesting question. With so much individual power, like somebody can make a video and put it on YouTube or create their own podcast, is there still as much of a need for community media, since when individual media is so empowered?
It's interesting. You know, it's going to take probably 6 months for this community media center to decide on a location, to bring in an executive director, another 6 months to build out the facility. You know, what do we do in that year? I agree with you, Julie. You know, there's no reason why they can't put up a website, you know, communitymediaofmarin.org, and start broadcasting content right now mm-hmm. over the Internet mm-hmm. and have a wider audience than just the distribution they would get from that channel mm-hmm. because, of course, they would only be able to see that cable channel right here in Marin, mm-hmm. whereas if they put it up on the web, anybody could see it. So mm-hmm. that's the difference between a physical community and a community of interest, right, mm-hmm. which could be geographically anywhere. But I think what the Community Media Center really adds is a place and a location. And you and I know it's great to be virtual, but it's also really wonderful to be able to interact with other people in the community. And you know also, you're running a radio show. You've got a technician there, I'm sure. You've got somebody who's manning, making sure that the tower doesn't go down, the transmitter is okay, that the electricity is plugged in, right? And then you come in and you do your show. Well, on a television show, imagine, you know, if you want just a simple interview with maybe one moderator and 2 or 3 guests, you're probably going to need 2 or 3 different camera people. You're going to have somebody working the mics. You might want to have somebody behind the scenes at the character generator to put people's titles underneath their names when they speak. You probably want to have a control room director who's managing all of this, a script. You know, so there's 4 or 5, maybe a half dozen people involved. So it's easy for you know, I think one level is bring out your cell phone, your digital camera, and take a picture of your kids or maybe Dennis Kucinich when he comes through town and mm-hmm. put it up on your website. There's a whole nother level when you start to getting into building a decent, you know, a more sophisticated show. And I think it's really important to have a training facility and volunteers and people in the community all getting together in one location.
Yeah, you're actually just speaking to the question of, you know, of collaborative art and collaborative expression as opposed to individual expression, or how do you build from individual expression to collaborative expression? And I agree that collaborative expression is just as important and really needs to be supported and nurtured, you know, in the same way.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you work together on a show with people, you build this camaraderie that goes outside of the show, you know. I know that when we taped some of the Marin Telecommunications Agency meetings and had them broadcast on Channel 26, you work together with people to get that done. And it's so important to not just, you know, I think so many musicians, especially filmmakers and authors, they kind of get in their own world as they're creating their work. Musicians are a little bit different. They always need to be out in front of people. And but it's authors and filmmakers are, I think it depends on the medium and what they're doing. One of the things this book teaches is it's not just for authors or filmmakers or musicians. It's for anybody. You know, I can't tell you how many people I meet who say they just want to help use these new tools to build their base so that they can get their message out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who would that apply to?
Mm-hmm.
Pastors, priests,
mm-hmm.
politicians, activists, Boy Scouts, girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone today is capable of using these new technologies to reach a wide audience.
Yeah, and I know, although there's some, you know, discussion about, well, is the quality going to drop because we don't have, you know, editors, so to speak, that if you look in general at the quality of anything from books to television shows, the gatekeeping system certainly hasn't, you know, produced only the best and the most wonderful, you know, sublime creations. It's let in, you know, all kinds of things, you know, from drivel to pornography and then up to great books and brilliant films. So the idea that we need gatekeepers or we need editors, you know, to sort of control the flow, I think is not valid.
Right, and you look at the spectrum. I got that from my editor. She wanted to make sure there was still a place for her. I think there's going to be even more opportunities for editors and copy editors and filters, because people are overwhelmed by information. But there is a spectrum, right? There are those people who are basically, you've got maybe a retiree who said, you know what, everyone keeps telling me they love my dishes and they've always wanted me to put together a cookbook. And they put together a small cookbook just for their friends and they self-publish mm-hmm. it, and it actually generates enough revenue so that they can do it without going broke. They don't
mm-hmm.
have to print 5,000 books
mm-hmm.
in advance like in the old model. Now mm-hmm. you can do print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
So much room for an editor there? Probably not. But when you get to the level like Be the Media, I was particularly careful, knowing that this book is going to be sitting on the shelf next to a book from Simon & Schuster or from Random House. I made very sure that it was edited. I'm making very sure that it's also copy edited. And then I got a solid designer for the cover. Because it's really important when you put a book out on the media that may talk about newspapers and editorial that it's edited properly, right?
That's a wonderful point, and I want to come back to the whole question of who's the expert and what does it mean to be an expert, and we'll actually be back with that in just a minute. You are listening to KWMR, Point Reyes Station, and Molinas. Take advantage of KWMR's new opinion forum, To the Point, and tell the world what's on your mind. You will have 90 seconds to express your sincere, intelligent thoughts on local or global topics. Please see our website, kwmr.org, or West Marin Post Offices for full details. Humor is welcome. No ranting, profanity, or slander. We enthusiastically accept To the Point broadcasts in Spanish. My name is Julie Motz. The program is Force and Feeling. And now we're going to return to our guest, David Matheson. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, Julie.
Yeah. And we were talking about this whole question of, you know, who's the expert and will experts still be needed? I've always been fascinated by the kind of historical flow from, you know, from expertise to individual mastery. In my own profession as a healer, I happen to believe that that you know, having professional healers is just a glitch in history, and that eventually people will be healing themselves and healing others. And I think there is a whole historical movement. I mean, originally only certain people were believed knew how to read and write, you know. And in fact, they would do the reading and the writing for other people. And then, in fact, the word glamour originally comes from grammar, you know, this idea that only special, magical people could do this. And then, what do you know, it turned out that everybody could learn how to read and write. And I think that this is also a movement in history, that more and more people, it's discovered that more and more people can do things that was originally thought only very special or specially trained people could do. So I'm not saying that we're going to throw out the editors or the book designers, you know, yet or even ever. But there is a feeling of more and more people, you know, kind of figuring out and learning how to do these things once the idea is put in their minds.
Absolutely. You know, when I was at Reuters, you know, there were a group of editors, group of journalists, and it was always fascinating to hear their stories and how hard it is to get a photo. You know, they would show you their wounds, literally bullet wounds from getting a photo in Northern Ireland during a conflict, and it was always touching to me. I'm very sensitive to the need for editorial, and then you've got the complete opposite extreme, which is, you know, indie media, and for example, wikis, the best example of which could be Wikimedia, but not the only example, where they don't want editors. You know, they clearly in one of the chapters in my book, there is a chapter called How to Create Your Zine Your Way, and a zine is just a small personal magazine. And the woman who created that chapter was very specific. She said, David, I do not want this chapter edited. And it was really hard for my editor not to edit her because it needed to be edited. But in some ways, we wanted the unedited voice in the book to show that there is a difference, and it's okay to say whatever you want, even if it's not exactly correct. And maybe sometimes you make it incorrect because you want to. You know, clearly the punk rock movement did that with their self-published zines in the 70s and 80s. They knew that mainstream media wasn't going to give them any credence on the airwaves and, you know, publicize them on television, so they created their own distribution networks. And some of the zines, they would say, please turn to page 4, and you'd turn to page 4, and it wasn't there. You know, they would do things on purpose, like bad spelling, so that it would give you the sense that you were actually at a punk rock concert. And so what's the spectrum, and where do people fall in that spectrum between we want no editorial at all the way to the other end, where we want experts in order to make it perfect? And certainly for encyclopedias and for reference works and for medical databases, you don't want to, you want to be on the opposite side of that extreme, right? But Reuters was interesting because you always saw that there were people who thought they knew more than the audience, and the editors would fascinate me because they would come up with this top 10 list of most important stories. And yet I was on the opposite extreme because I was sending their content out to online sites, and I would see that the most important or the most widely read stories had nothing to do with what the editors thought the most important stories were. And that fascinated me, that chasm. And it usually generated entertainment news, which is sad. Maybe the sad truth about what people want to read is that, you know, the Tom Cruise story, for example, on where he ate lunch with Nicole Kidman, for example, was more important or more widely read than an important political story or an important economic story.
Well, the interesting thing with the internet is that you can actually get instant feedback about which stories are the most popular and which stories are being most widely read. So you could be continually polling and changing and polling and changing your presentation accordingly.
Yeah, in 1999, I patented a tracking mechanism that allowed a company like Reuters to view how widely read their stories were across geographical distribution. So again, you could see, wow, that news on the orange crop was really popular in Florida, obviously.
Okay, I have a question for you, because my theory is that even accurate data does not make people change their operations if it doesn't suit their personal needs. So did things change at Reuters? Did the editors change as a result of the feedback they were getting?
Absolutely.
I mean,
to a degree, some things have stayed the same. Yeah. But to another large degree, you know, they refused to put an advertiser. Reuters wanted to keep arm's distance from advertisers on the web. They didn't want their news to be perceived as being biased in any way. And so one day, I remember this very vividly, we went to a board meeting, and we opened up the Wall Street Journal, and we tried to tell them, look, here's a Reuters story, and just to the left of it is an advertisement, you know, but you're keeping an arm's distance away on print in the internet, but you're not doing it in print and on TV and on the radio. So what we did was we structured it so that Reuters, the website would go out and get the advertisers, just like in the print world, so that this way Reuters could, you know, maintain their independence. from corporations. So it was. They did shift their business. They did start doing things differently. Mm-hmm. And also, the goal wasn't just to make money, right? Mm-hmm. The goal was to get their content in as many different places as possible to be widely recognized as an expert in news.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, they also shifted to some degree. They decided it was more important to be ubiquitous than to be generating revenue at every turn.
David, before we go on talking any more about your wonderful book, Be the Media, would you be kind enough to tell our listeners how they can get a copy?
Sure. They can go to the book will be published in later this year, and advanced sales copies are $29.95. It's a $6 savings between now and when it's published. And you can get it from www.bethemedia.com. That's bethemedia.com, and you can just click on order. There's an order form.
Terrific.
On there, and we take all major credit cards.
Good. I just wanted to make sure that that information was out.
One of the points to Julie in doing it myself and self-publishing it, it's important. What we're trying to teach people to do is self-publish it themselves so that they maintain control and keep a majority of the royalties in order to give back. And a lot of what I'm doing is giving back a percentage of the proceeds to a lot of the nonprofits that I care about. And a lot of folks on the listening may wonder, well, why isn't it on Amazon? I'm not sure many people know, but definitely every author and musician knows that anytime Amazon sells a book, they take 50% of the revenues.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to get a distributor to get in there, and they'll take 15%. And also, Amazon owns the end user. They own the customer contact information. So the author never turns into sort of knowing who their customers are and how to work with them.
You never get to build your audience,
exactly.
Essentially.
So that's one of the reasons I'm doing it all from BeTheMedia.com, in case anyone's wondering.
I think it's fantastic that you're actually modeling the very thing that you're writing about.
Right, and trying to teach people. Hopefully they can stand up on my shoulders and do even more than this next time.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about a controversy that has always, you know, interested me in the terms of, well, on many levels. You know, part of your desire is to empower artists. But what about the whole idea of people, you know, doing free downloads of artist material off the internet? And where does that come into all of this?
Right. I mean, if an artist puts up their content for free and encourages people to use it, which is, again, a good way to get distribution and word-of-mouth spread, that's one thing. But if people are taking someone's content, no matter what it is, without that author's, musician or filmmaker's authorization, and, you know, using it for free when it wasn't intended to be for free, we have a word for that. It's called stealing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it never ceases to amaze me. You go to a concert, and I've been to them, where people will go up and, you know, one person will buy one CD from their favorite artist performing there, and another one will buy another, and then they just burn each other a copy of the CD. Well, if you love the artist that much, why aren't you, you know, giving it to them? And I don't fault the American people, because the American people are habituated to pay $20 for a piece of plastic, of which maybe one or two songs are good, right? And we've become habituated to thinking that, you know, well, 99% out of every dollar is going to go to the artist. Well, it's not. 99% out of every dollar goes to the executives, the attorneys, the fat cats, the distributors, the resellers. Authors, musicians, filmmakers are the last in line at the trough. So, again, one of the things we're teaching in the music and the film chapter in Be the Media is to support your, you know, if you really love Chuck Berry, support Chuck Berry. Don't support his label and his art. You know, we're trying to reemphasize this new way of doing business where artists should take control of their destiny and of their content, and fans should move more towards, away from being a consumer of a product and towards being a patron of that artist, to support that artist if you love that artist so much.
Is that happening more and more? Are there any top artists now who are just going completely around the studio system and just saying, I'm going to put my stuff out on the web and let people buy it song by song?
Yep. A couple of great examples would be Prince. You know, he actually fought his label because he wanted to produce more music each year.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to get music out to his fans, and his label said no, and he created an NPG and has his own label, and basically comes out with double and triple disc sets, you know, and those 99-cent songs as well that are sold off of his website, and the majority of that revenue goes to him. Natalie Merchant of 10,000 Maniacs, Natalie Merchant had Myth America, M-Y-T-H, Myth
mm-hmm.
America,
mm-hmm.
Was her new album, and that was her own label. And certainly local musicians like Bonnie Hayes, who's written a lot of top songs for everyone from Cher to Santana to Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie Hayes has her own label, Bondage Records, and she released her new CD through Bondage, and it's up and available on places like CDBaby.com. Shanna Morrison, you know, daughter of Van the Man Morrison, another local musician who has her own label and is doing things herself. It's heading in that direction. The more interesting thing is film. You know, the bigger digital asset of a film. Robert Greenwald, I think, is doing an excellent job of that. He sold 50,000 DVDs through MoveOn.org by using house parties. Mm-hmm. Talk of an alternative distribution mechanism. Mm-hmm. Instead of worrying about when you're going to get your theatrical release, why not do it through online sites? Mm-hmm. And he made millions of dollars, which was contributed back to MoveOn and Center for American Progress. So again, he gave back. He had enough of the royalties to be able to give back to groups he cares about.
And how do you feel this popularization of the media is going to, has affected and is going to continue to affect our political process?
Yeah. It, you know, two big ways. One is, we discussed before, so I'll be very brief, which is bringing policy out into the open. The policy-making process was generally done behind closed doors, and I think now that people are becoming aware of what is being done in their name, it's changed the landscape to the point where Senator Dick Durbin actually went online to get people's feedback on legislation for a national broadband policy. I mean, that was unheard of before the legislation was even introduced. He went online to get feedback from people. So on the one hand, that's going on. On the other hand, look at what this was really, they're calling it the YouTube election this year.
Yeah. I actually have a question for you about that. It just suddenly popped into my mind. If I'm interested in legislation in any given area, let's say agriculture, is there some way I can go up on the web and find out what bills are in the House, what bills are in the Senate, what bills are pending in the state legislatures? Is there any site that allows you to do that?
You know, I'm aware of these from a media perspective, but not for oil and gas and for, you know, agriculture and things like that. The wonderful thing about what FreePress.net did was they, because they brought media policy out into the open, we're hoping that it funnels through onto oil and gas policy. And you know, but because of the nature of media, where the media has a hard time covering itself, and now it is in some ways becoming more open, I wonder if, like, oil and gas will be, and foreign policy might be some of the very last issues or the last groups that will come to this sort of bringing things out into the light. They may be a little slower to the gate.
Well, I was thinking it'd be wonderful if every, you know, legislator, every chair of a major subcommittee would be willing to, like, turn to the public the way Dick Durbin did, but they wouldn't need that if there was some automatic way that you could, you know, track legislation.
Right. And there may be some callers, as usual, the audience may know more than you and I. And then we go back to the expert issue, which is who's an expert. You know, it certainly is always interesting to gather that feedback from people out there in the audience.
Yeah. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. The program is Force and Feeling. I'm your host, Julie Motz, and my guest today is David Matheson, author of a book that's soon to be published called Be the Media. And David, I wanted to just read the table of contents, if that's okay with you, because
sure.
I think each chapter really suggests a world of, you know, of fascinating possibilities for people. So the first chapter is, let me just find that here, is, well, part one, Me Media, the Personal Media Renaissance. So there's a chapter on books, how to self-publish a book. There's a chapter on community newspapers, how to create a high school, college, or community newspaper. Chapter three is called We Media, Participatory Media and Citizen Journalism. Learn how to create a successful, oh, sorry, no, I've skipped over to part two there, sorry. Chapter two is film, how to create and distribute a digital film. Chapter three is video, the GoogTube generation. Promote your video using internet, TV, video blogs, YouTube. Music, the new musical model. Music, how to make music with just three chords and the truth. That was most appealing to me. Podcasting, how to podcast. Radio, how to create and self-syndicate a radio show. Of course, we still want people to program over KWMR, but it's another fascinating possibility.
Okay.
Blogs, how to create, promote, and syndicate your blog. Internet, how to optimize your site for e-commerce. Syndication, how to self-syndicate to print. And I'm just looking at my...
Yeah, how to syndicate to print websites. And, you know, also magazines and newspapers.
Yeah. Online outlets. Licensing. How to license your ideas without selling your soul. And finally, in part one, zines. Be a zinester. How and why to publish your own periodical.
Which was unedited, as we discussed.
Yes. And why would somebody want to publish their own magazine? What would the driving interest in that be?
You know, it's all over the map. I mean, it really started with fanzines back in the 50s, you know, where the fans actually... read, for example, Ray Bradbury, who was a famous, before he wrote his books, he was a fanzine writer as well. He wrote basically fanzines for science fiction articles and magazines. And it was this whole sort of beginnings, maybe, of participatory media, where the fans were actually writing articles and trading these magazines amongst themselves and with each other, you know, and mailing lists that they would find at the back of the zines. But it could be for anyone, you know, anyone who wants to get a point across or who wants to get no point across at all. One of the women in the book, the woman who made that article, actually had a zine called Anne Zine because her name is Anne, and she wanted to have a zine that was specifically towards people named Anne.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasted a couple of years, and she met other women named Anne, and they would trade Anne Zine amongst each other. But, you know, just for fun, just to publish and just to realize that, you know what? You don't have to make money to make media. It doesn't have to be all about becoming a media mogul. It can be just about expressing yourself, your creativity.
That's a wonderful thought that you can, you know, that it doesn't have to be, that the patron can essentially be yourself.
Exactly. That's true.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So after going from a time of patrons, actually, to a time of, you know, broad audiences, but where you also needed the patron, at least of the publisher, you've gone to a place where you can reach a broad audience with self-patronizing. Actually, doesn't sound like such a great phrase, but being your own patron in that
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. And Anne gives a great example in the book where someone was a gas cap zinester, and he basically just wrote this little zine that fit inside of people's gas caps, and then it would be distributed because you would put it, the person who created it, would wait at gas stations, would be a gas station attendant, and put these little zines inside of people's caps, and maybe they'd read them, maybe they wouldn't, mm-hmm. but that was her distribution mechanism, was basically just working at a gas station, so she'd get her zine distributed to other gas station attendants who may be pulling out that gas cap one day.
So in any situation where you're serving the public, you actually have an ability to publish yourself in one way or another.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now I wanted to read the chapter headings from Part 2, We Media, the Community Media Renaissance. Community Radio Station. Chapter 2 is Community Newspapers. Chapter 3 is We Media, Participatory Media and Citizen Journalism. Chapter 4 is Community TV Station. Chapter 5 is Community Access TV Show. Chapter 6 is Community Internet. What exactly do you mean by that, Community Internet?
Well, you know, the point is, if the cable and telecommunications companies are trying to, 99.9% of broadband distribution to residents is delivered by one of two companies, a telephone company or a cable company. So they really have a monopoly or duopoly over access to the public broadband internet. And so if that's the case, what we're trying to pitch in that chapter is a community internet, which is, you know, being attempted in San Francisco, it's being attempted in Philadelphia. They call it Wi-Fi. I wanted it to be a little bit broader than Wi-Fi because Wi-Fi might be, you know, a 1999 solution to a 2010 problem. We need sort of broader and deeper access than just a couple of Wi-Fi points at slow speeds. We need wider speed. But the point in the community internet chapter, again, is to give control of this critical access to the internet to the community and not just to a corporation, because we've seen how they can run, you know, wild over the community and the public interest if they're allowed to. And the other point, too, about having a sort of a We Media first half of the book and a community media in the second half was, if you've just created music or if you've just created a video or a book, you can only go so far by yourself. You really want to get engaged in the community and start there. Nobody goes from no audience to a national audience, especially, as you know, in radio. You don't hit the national spot market till you've got major affiliates in small market, mid-market, and large market. So you've got to start somewhere. And what we try to say in the book was, hey, you know, if your music, here's how you can create music. Now the next step is you may want to distribute it. Well, here's how you can create a label. Mm-hmm. Then the next step is, well, you say you're not getting on the radio. Here's how you can create your own radio show, right? You say your radio show is not getting aired in the right time. Well, in part two, we teach you actually how to create a radio station. So what we're trying to say is no excuses, folks. You know, like enough whining. There are plenty there. Okay, mainstream media is controlling a lot of content creation and distribution, but there are a lot of opportunities out there for you to go ahead and do these things and build an audience yourself now. If we're careful and we watch ourselves with this net neutrality issue, there really could be the opportunity for anyone to take advantage of this renaissance.
So community internet is one of the ways of sort of guaranteeing net neutrality or helping to keep net neutrality, you know, real.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. And that was a real goal of Free Press and others, was to start getting municipalities to realize you don't have to rely on Comcast or AT&T to get access to the internet. You should be relying on your local government as well, or individual or private groups within your local community that may want to fund a community internet, low-cost Wi-Fi, hotspots at, you know, Starbucks or other areas. I shouldn't bring up Starbucks, but, you know, public libraries or community media centers. So that's why we put the community internet chapter in there. Probably nobody's going to buy the book for most of the second half of the book, but that's the reason I self-published, is I feel that these messages don't get out there with a traditional book, because most publishers would say, Dave, the book's too long already. Cut out the community internet part. Cut out the community media center part. But to me, those are just as critical as the opportunities in the first half of the book, like teaching people how to blog and podcast. It's just as important to teach people that there are ways of working around this constricted media monopoly environment that we find ourselves in.
Well, would you consider also having an internet distribution whereby people for a fee could download a chapter at a time?
Sure.
Chapter
Absolutely.
By chapter?
Well, you know, one of the goals, once this book is printed, I am certainly going to have electronic versions of appropriate chapters. So, for example, it makes a lot of sense to have the internet chapter as an e-book or the podcast chapter as an e-book. Mm-hmm. It may not make as much sense to have the newspaper chapter as an electronic version, but some of them lend themselves very well to electronic versions. Okay. I'll also probably be putting up a couple of free chapters soon, most likely the policy chapter. Mm-hmm. I want people to be aware of that, so we'll probably give that away for free as well.
One of the things that appeals to me about all this as a healer is that one of the things I hear over and over again with my patients is that they weren't heard at home. They weren't heard. They weren't listened to. I mean, this is a theme, you know, that I get over and over again with people who come to me for healing. And when you said no excuses, you know, the idea that now people can be heard, you know, people whose voices were never heard for all kinds of reasons can be heard, is tremendously exciting.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable time to be alive. And, you know, the promise is that you don't need, the promise here is twofold. One is that everyone has a voice now. And the second promise is that you don't need to rely on these traditional gatekeepers in order to be successful. And in some ways, you could see those as abusive relationships. You know, an author signing an abusive contract with a publisher where they only get pennies mm-hmm. per book, or a musician. I mean, the music industry is littered with tales of musicians who've been abused by the system, from John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater to Chuck Berry, who fought for 30 years to get the rights back to Maybelline, to Leanne Rimes, who signed a 15-record deal when she was just 14 years old. This is slavery. And I think now that musicians and authors and filmmakers are starting to realize, wow, we're in this abusive relationship, the problem with that is, number one, you need to admit that you're in an abusive relationship, which is extremely hard. But then even harder is to move on to new alternatives. And if there are no alternatives out there being pointed out to you, it's a treacherous and scary step. So I'm hoping that this book at least makes people aware that you don't need to enter into abusive contracts anymore. And consumers need to be aware of that as well, so they're not continuing to perpetuate a model that may be abusive to the very artists that they love and support or want to support.
You know, we have only a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you one more question. You know, we live in a country where everybody can vote, but very few people do. So how can we ensure that when this incredible, you know, right, privilege, you know, ability becomes available to people, how can we sustain people's enthusiasm about using it?
You know, I think a lot of the rock the vote initiatives. And, you know, Frank Zappa did this 20 years ago, where whenever he would get on TV, he would encourage people to vote. This is the 1980s. You know, here we are 20 years later. We're still trying to get youth to vote. We're still trying to get people involved. And it's a challenge. And I really admire those musicians and those filmmakers like Robert Greenwald, those musicians. Like, there were a lot of them the last time around that got up and did the Rock the Vote tour. So I think that's a great way to get youth involved. As far as the rest of the majority of the population that doesn't vote, I don't have all the answers. You know,
and
I think
my question was really, though, how can we assure that that kind of lethargy doesn't start relating to this kind of expression? In other words, we've seen it happen in the phenomenon of voting, where people can vote, but they don't.
But they don't, right. How do you do it with media?
Yeah, exactly. People can use the media. How can we make sure they stay enthusiastic and doing that?
Right. And I think it usually relates to people do want to be heard, but if they don't get any feedback, it's like a tree falling in the forest.
Yeah.
I think it's always great to support those people that are trying to get their media out there in all different ways. And actually, I would say that we're probably on the opposite extreme of that. It seems like lots of people are taking advantage of this opportunity. I think the youth are taking advantage of this opportunity, though, more than middle-aged and older people. It's really hard for them to get a shift around this. And that's why I did it in book format. I'm trying to reach an audience that's not on the web, that's not used to these new tools, and to show them, hey, things have changed. I don't think we need to teach this to the youth. All you have to do is look on their cell phone and see what they've got programmed in for music and photos and everything, and then look at an older person's phone. They generally don't take all advantage of it.
Well, thank you so much for reaching the KWIMR audience, David. My guest has been David Matheson, author of Be the Media, www.bethemedia.org, if you want to order this really extraordinary book. Thank you, David. It's been wonderful spending time with you.
Thank you, Julie.
Nessa rua, nessa rua, tem bosque que se chama, sol.